Hello, America, and all of our listeners all over the world. You're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I am your host with the most, Brandon Perkins. Joining me, as always, is Lifo Dinolfo, Patrick Mifflin, and Chris Sologi. Say hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey. Yeah, so we are 1 week away from Thanksgiving in the U.S. now. Just going to go ahead and let everybody know we're not going to be having a show next week because we won't be here, or we will be still getting over the turkey coma or the hangover.
I'm still going to be drunk.
Yeah. And Patrick will be well pickled. So, suffice to say, we'll all have our reasons for not being here. Yeah. But we will, of course, be on Sunday.
Yep.
But, we actually did have a sort of a big game release this week, and some of us have been kind of working on it. I only got to play it a little bit of it last night, so I don't have a whole lot to add, but I did finish Death Stranding. We'll get to all that. Amongst this week, we will once again be getting into the impeachment watch, because
still going on, folks.
Yeah, it's still going on. It might be wrapping up fairly soon, at least this part of it. And it was not a good week for Donald Trump, like, at all. Because one of the witnesses that was supposed to be, like, the Republican star witness kind of sort of implicated just about the entire Trump administration.
That was glorious.
Yeah. And once the stooges on the council realized what the fuck had just happened, well, you could read it on their faces.
Yes. Yeah. The memes are flowing like the Nile.
Yeah. Obviously, that wasn't the only thing we had. We also had the Atlanta Democratic debate. We also got some Chick-fil-A news, and
it's not really news.
Yeah. We got some other fast food news, including something involving the Impossible Whopper. Someone who does that one major mistake involving email that I think at least all of us will probably make at least once in our lifetime.
Yeah.
One way to avoid is never email anybody.
Yeah. Of course, we'll also have our entertainment portion as well. Including Apple kind of having to cancel the premiere of what was going to be sort of their big film day premiere because the son of the subject of the film kind of sort of may have raped someone. We'll get to it. Oh, and also Jordan Peele showed his new series that he's releasing for Amazon Prime. So all that and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. So start us off, as always. Bill, what have you been up to this week?
So now that I have a computer that's stable again.
Yay.
No crashy. That's good. I've just been getting everything, buttoned back up. I got my Plex server installed again and working. I got basically all my storage hooked back up, just getting everything back to the way it was. So that I can continue, using my emulation and stuff, all that good thing. Luckily, I didn't have to reset that whole drive up because I had my launch box set up on an external drive, so it just kind of transferred along with it. So, which is good because I put a lot of hours into that setup.
Yeah.
So, yeah, don't want to lose that. Apart from that, I started playing Shining Force CL on the Genesis in earnest now, there's some very interesting additions to that game. For one thing, they make the game speed 4 by default now. So it's really fucking fast. Maybe a bit too much. 4 was always a little bit more than I particularly cared for. But yeah, you can still set that down. Another thing that's kind of interesting about it is when you go and raise people at the church, now you can raise everybody at once. That's a nice quality of life improvement there. The game is a lot more challenging. I actually had to egress from the very first battle.
Mm-hmm.
And not to say that it's, like, you know, impossible or overly hard. It's just that, well, the enemies that you're going to be facing are quite a bit beefier than they were originally. And their tactics are different. So you can't go into it with the same strategy that you had before, because that don't work. Yeah, so it's basically playing an entirely different game, but with the Shining Force coat of paint on it. And yeah, I'm taking it. So I'm going to keep on playing that on my Raspberry Pi. Just after the show, I'll probably get back into that.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very nice. I like ROM hacking, especially when people make stuff that's, you know, not stupid. Like putting the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in Streets of Rage, which oddly works for some reason, but hey, that is kind of dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... but apart from that, well, you know, like Brandon said, Thanksgiving is coming. Over here, we've already had ours. So now it's just waiting for Black Friday to see if there's any interesting sales on GOG.com that I might want to take advantage of. So that's about it for me.
All right, Pat, what about you?
Well, with me settling back into my old role at work, I'm actually getting caught up on X-Men comics again, and at this point I'm pretty sure Marauders is going to be my long-term favorite. The entire motif of just being pirates, getting mutants out of non-treaty nations that don't recognize Krakoa's sovereignty, or in the case of Russia, they were trying to conscript them all. So that,
you get
that
the
went
feeling that the You get the feeling that the team behind this current iteration of the Marauders might be fans of Black Lagoon?
It's possible, but they're definitely showing some restraint if they are. That being said...
I mean, it's Marvel. I mean, if they did go full Black Lagoon, then I don't think Marvel would let them publish it.
Yeah, Bob Iger would get acid reflux.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we still do see Kate do some pretty cool shit. Like, in the first issue, she phases a gun into the thighs of two soldiers that they're fighting.
Mm.
So that's probably going to be an amputation for both of them. But, yeah, it's just them being high-functioning alcoholics and technically being the good guys, even though they occasionally do kind of shady things. Mm-hmm. And it's been a lot of fun. So also I have to say that the current writing of Emma Frost in all of the X books has been one of the high points of the reboot. So you know, if you're a White Queen fan, then definitely check those out. And yeah, I'm enjoying the whole reboot all around, but I'm starting to see what books I might not latch onto for the long haul. So, we'll see. But I'm having a good time right now.
All right, Chris, what about you?
Yeah, I've been streaming a lot this week. We did Remnants. I forget what the name is, From the Ashes, I think.
Yeah.
The sort of Dark Souls-style action third-person shooter kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it works out pretty well. Played through the first dungeon, which... took a few tries just to kind of get the hang of what was going on there, and figuring out like when you need to use your guns and versus melee, which there's a lot of fodder in that first one.
Mm-hmm.
These like little round dudes that just charge at you, and these like weird pustule dudes that shoot out rot, something like that, like some sort of illness thing that's... you definitely want to shoot from range, and then just getting these random, like, not really bosses, but like dudes that at least they show a health bar for, that you kind of have to do some work on, whether you're just trying to avoid their shots or try and figure out when to best take shots at them. So a couple times I would get far enough that I was just like, well, I need to run back and warp out and kind of get back to the base and kind of upgrade some of my stuff, which I think was what helped me out with the boss. I think I got that on the second try. So that wasn't too bad. It just took a while to get through that. But yeah, that game's pretty cool.
Mm.
Also stream Shenmue 3. I did that Tuesday and Thursday. And I'm liking that game a lot.
Yeah.
Control-wise, it feels very much modern.
Yeah.
Good.
You know,
Thank
you move
God.
Around. you can hold the right trigger to just run everywhere.
Yep.
The only caveat is that you run out of stamina, which is looks like a health bar at first, but it just keeps running out as you're doing stuff around the day.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get to, I think, the final three where it starts turning yellow, and you start running, you just potentially could pass out, I think. I haven't gotten that far yet, but yeah, you kind of have to, when you're going to do something that needs you to have some health for fighting or sparring or whatever, you need to eat some food, which is just a lot of like fruit or vegetables or garlic or stuff like that. Nothing really gamey about it as far as like what you're eating. Other than when you get like prizes or stuff like that, it's like, oh, here's some bananas. And it gives you like 90 HP and you have like 1,200 total.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. That is a little bit weird, but yeah, the thing that's very much Shenmue is the dialogue and way you interact with people, which is the same kind of Ryo has this objective he needs to talk to people about, and some of them either just have no interest in talking to you about that or just doing dumb stuff. Like there's an old man you meet in the village who has a very fucked up face. He is often like just talking about nonsense the first couple sentences. And Ryo is like, what? Manages to get him onto track sometimes to actually answer his questions. Things like that. And there's been a couple conversations where it's like, I don't know if these people are having the same conversation at each other. Which is pretty funny at times. But yeah, let's see. There's lots of little mini games in there in the town. You can spar with there's a dude in the town that is teaching kids some martial arts stuff, Tai Chi. Mm-hmm. But you can also go up to a little what they call martial hall. It's a martial mm-hmm. arts dojo that you can kind of do your own sparring and rank up your kung fu, which my Ryo has a level 3 kung fu. But you can also upgrade your like special moves. Which you can either button out or I think use the right trigger when you're fighting to pull them out. And the way they train that stuff is weird. Because initially I didn't understand it because it just keeps popping up this like QTE version of like the face buttons and just flashes these buttons. And you're like, what the hell's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Then you eventually figure out, oh, it's wanting me to do the combo at this specific moment and perfectly time it, I guess. For maximum upgrades for those specific attacks. So, like, I have the, I forget what it's called, the tornado kick, which is him doing, like, two quick roundhouse kicks. For whatever reason, it feels like it's sped up, like, to 1.5 times speed,
mm-hmm.
The way it's done, where it's, like, very anime speed. And, yeah, you have to do that because one of the people you come to get information is, like, no, you have to fight me or else I'm not going to tell you, sort of thing, which he whoops your ass at first. And that's like where it tells you like, hey, you should go to the dojo and train. They have like rankings there too for you have to beat certain monks to sort of rank up at that dojo, but you don't need to do that to
mm-hmm.
actually level up your abilities. So it seems like there's a lot of moves to collect and like ways of comboing that stuff together that seems like it could be pretty cool, but early on, it's a bit sloppy, just as you're trying to figure out how it all works. But yeah, like lots of mini games. Like there's two gamblers doing like pail toss, to throw a ball into these pails to win prizes, like a digital clock or a soccer ball or a pineapple. There's lucky hit. There's a bunch of lucky hit boards actually. There's two that's right near the town center, and then there's this whole area where they have to get tokens to like gamble on this stuff. There's also turtle races. There's this weird game that you have to play to advance the story. I forget what it's called, but it's basically you're just rolling this ball around a bowl, and depending on what side of the bowl it lands, you have to bet on which one you think it's going to land on. kind of thing. There's like another dice game. Some weird stuff. The one girl that's running the lucky hit board boards is like constantly hitting on you, sort of thing, which is pretty weird. And yeah, the game's just, it's very weird. It's still Shenmue, but it's also feels much better to play. There's lots of gacha machines and a whole side quest with this kid. You talk to him and he's like, I have no money. My grandpa's very sick and I need money for the medicine and I'm going to sell my capsule collections and I just need this one. And it's like, okay, I guess I can do that. And it's like the most rare one in this machine. It's like a, it's this machine of toy fishing lures with hooks on them. It's like, these are not toys. These are fucking sharp objects kids can poke themselves with and hurt themselves. But I spent probably about $300 on that machine.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like $5 a pull. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of attempts. And the nice thing is that it kind of goes through them pretty fast. So you're not sitting there like staring at it for 10 seconds, like moving the camera around.
Yeah.
So you can kind of move through them pretty fast. There's one that has like a bunch of like 5 Shenmue characters from the original game, which has like little toy capsules of versions of characters. There's one that has construction equipment, one that has like tennis rackets, little mini tennis rackets. So I got the kid the one he needed after many attempts, and him making comments like, oh, cool, for like the 20th time you got this blue lure. I'm like, it's not cool, Ryo. You've gotten 20 of these. You don't need this crap anymore. And then took it back and he's like, that's not going to pay for enough. So I need you to get this diamond pea gem. As this capsule machine, I guess, that has spits out like these weird toy diamonds that I don't have access to yet. Cause you can't go to all parts of the town, at the forefront of the story. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to progress and then you'll eventually get access to the other areas, which, there's like a bar area that has like a nightlife for you to do stuff that is pretty cool. So yeah, there's also a whole thing where it's like, oh, you have to come back here at 7 o'clock. You can just hit a button to fast forward. That's pretty nice. Yeah. And it'll also just warp you around. Like if you have to get back to Shenhua's house at 9, if you don't, it'll just warp you there. So there's some nice stuff like that that makes the time management much less of an issue than it was in, like, the first game.
Oh, yeah. That was, like, God, yeah. Because, see, that was one of the biggest problems I had with the first game was, you know, because there's just so much you can do in that game that, and the way that the, you know, the time moves in that first game is just such bullshit.
Yeah, especially because the map and your sense of where everything is at is not good at all for a while.
Nope.
So you can easily just get lost trying to figure out, okay, where the fuck is this place? Especially because you had to look up like actual signs with maps on them.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. Right here, he has you have like a little mini map, as well as like in your notebook, you have a couple of maps. It kind of lays out the village, but it's not great when you're like at the end of your first day, it's like, oh, you have to go back to Shenhua's house. I'm like, where the fuck is that? Because you just got to this village because it just warps you along to the village from her house. And so you're like, how the fuck do I get back? And you look at the map and it's has names for places, but you're like, I have no idea where any of these places are at. Mm-hmm. Which it could use like a, you know, video gamey like arrow that shows you like, here's where you're at mm-hmm. right now kind of thing. So it took me like 3 days to be able to get back to Shenhua's house on time or warped because I had no clue which way to go. But another big part of this game is collecting herbs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you get a lot of your money early on, I would assume, is you go walking around in the fields and such, and you have to be in first-person view because you see these items with red circles on them, and I was like, oh, I guess I can't pick this up right now. And then I figure out later, it's like, oh, I have to be in first-person view to pick up this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sell it to the guy that runs the shop because he's going to turn it into medicine, I guess, if you have the right combos.
Yep.
And so you just basically want to collect as much as you can especially some of the rare stuff that I haven't seen yet, like Cinnamon and something else, I forget. But you turn them in, it's like, all right, I got like $500 out of this. That's where I was like, all right, we're going to that gotcha machine. We're getting that fucking white lure because we're not leaving until we do this fucking side quest. Now is this a good chunk of the second stream, which is doing that and be like, oh my God, where's – I should have bought enough to empty out this machine from the start. But I don't think you can sell the excess capsules either. So that's kind of a shame too, but – even if it was for like $1 each, something like that. But yeah, so yeah, I have that save, and they also have like a lot of the same stuff from like you go into Shenhua's house, and there's a bunch of drawers you can open up, and the vast majority of them have nothing in them that you can do anything with. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, here's because you're in her dad's room because mm-hmm. her dad's missing, and that's kind of the central plot point that's pushing this early part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Besides the revenge. Eventually, but her father needs help, or you got to figure out what happened to him. So you're going to stay in his room, and like you're looking at his drawers, like, oh, there's clothes, there's booze, there's clothes. You can't do anything with any of this stuff. And it's like, yep, that's Shenmue, all right?
Yeah.
Especially because it takes a while, because you have to look in first person, it zooms in, you're like, all right, let's open this. And maybe it has something in there that you can look at, and he just comments on it, and then you're like, okay, I guess that was it. And I'll just close this and back out, and then, all right, maybe to the next thing. It's like, all right, this is too much. Especially because when you get back to the house, usually Shenhua's making dinner, and you never see them eating dinner.
Oh.
It just, like, warps to the bed at a certain time, or you just are like, all right, we talked about stuff. And not doing much of anything about it. But yeah, it's a lot of fun to play. I'm looking forward to putting some more time into that.
There's no arcades, though, in this Shenmue 3, as I heard.
Not yet, at least. It's very much like a remote town in China, I think it is.
Mm.
I mean, this is like, if this is China, this is like China in the late 80s, so.
Yeah, it's March 87.
Yep. Mm.
So they make a big deal, like when it gets nighttime, it's like, oh, here's lights going on around this town.
Yeah.
I think like Shenhua has like an actual generator at her house.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like what's powering them.
So you're really out in the sticks.
Her yeah. house is way far away from everybody else.
I mean, this is not just any kind of sticks. This is like People's Republic of China sticks. Like,
yeah, like there's large fields and rice paddies and stuff like that around. Lots of cow pastures, like very much farm town.
Mm.
Where the most excitement these kids have to keep them entertained in the day is doing martial arts training from a really big hairy guy.
Yeah.
Who very much looks like maybe the guy from Journey to the West, like a monkey guy.
Kind of like that.
That's how his face kind of looks to me. It's like the lead they usually have for that kind of adaption for that story.
Mm-hmm.
Though he's much bigger. But yeah, it's pretty cool. They've definitely done a very good job considering they don't have a huge budget for this game to kind of mm-hmm. make it, you know, feel it looks really nice. It's maybe a little bit of frame rate issues, but not much. Yeah, it just plays pretty well. The only real issue is it could be a little bit clearer with the inventory stuff, like what you got that you can sell and all that. But otherwise, it's kind of Shenmue, but 2019.
Hmm.
And it's kind of 2019's been kind of a crazy year because one of the big games that opened it was Kingdom Hearts 3, and one that's ending is Shenmue 3. It's like games okay. that were well.
So I'm looking at some of the information here. Yeah, there are arcades in Shenmue 3.
What okay. games do they have?
Well, amongst them, let's see. Yeah, I had it just a second ago. Let's see. Oh, yeah, here we go. Let's see. They got a variety of new mini games. Some old ones return. None of the Sega arcade games return. Among the new games is Chobuchan Fighter, which is an affectionate parody of Virtua Fighter 2.
Huh.
Considering this is China, of course it would all be bootleg.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, because you haven't gotten
time warping.
Yeah.
Virtua Fighter 2.
Yeah, you actually do can find a Sega Saturn in Shenmue 3. That's like hidden somewhere.
Oh. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad they still kept their timeline intact then.
Yep.
Also, yeah, like, they got the Astro City arcade cabinets too.
Hmm. I gotta play this soon.
Yeah. I'm working my way towards the actual bars where I assume that stuff is at.
Probably. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, for the time being, I'm sectioned off to like the main village and this sunflower area.
Hmm.
Where, yeah, you run into some kids and they're like, let's play hide and seek. I'm like, what the fuck, kids? I'm just kind of some shit to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all hide and like, you see like three of them see where they hide and it's like, oh, okay, well, I know exactly where you are.
You guys are really not very good at this.
No. But yeah, the sunflower patch is nearby. The one girl's hiding in. It's like every other path that doesn't lead to her has herbs at the end of it. So it's like, all right, at least pick up some stuff, useful stuff on the way to figuring her out. But yeah, it works out pretty well. Mm. Also been playing, getting back into Death Stranding.
Yep.
And that bike really makes a big deal.
Oh, yes, it does.
Especially, I was going to try and see if I could get up one of the mountains, but I realized it was too steep, and so I just drove through the mule camp and just right back out, and they couldn't do anything about it.
Yep.
They were alerted, but it was like, I'm gone as soon as they were able to even do anything about it. There were people that made bridges over some of those rivers going back towards the first city, mm-hmm. So that was pretty nice. Though I also had to figure out how to repair it. Because by the time I got the generator going and all that, it was pretty rusted and, like, sparking as I was driving through
mm-hmm.
The area. And now those quests for delivering stuff to some of the areas is less treacherous, except maybe that wind farm.
Oh, yeah.
Because that seems like the place, like, all right, maybe we don't deliver here anymore. Mm-hmm. Just call it a hazardous area, because I assume there are BTs every time you go over there.
Yeah.
And, yeah, kind of just continuing to push along there. And that's been pretty much it. How about you, Brandon?
All right. Well, first and foremost, I finished Death Stranding. So I've started writing my review. Hopefully I'll have it up by next week. But yeah, the way that game ends is just pure Kojima. In that it is basically one long, almost feature-length film cutscene with occasional interactive bits.
Mm.
Thank God it's actually good, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't really want to add too much more, because I don't want to spoil a whole lot, but later on in the game, you do get some... Like, I know that Chris is still kind of sort of in the beginning of the game. If anybody who's playing this game, I will usually tell you the first few hours are actually the hardest part of this game, because you don't have all of the extensive amount of equipment that you get to, deal with a lot of these later stuff things. Like eventually you do get like, firearms and, in this one, firearms, there's like three kinds. There's the non-lethal firearms that fire, rubber bullets. And if you use those against, mules or terrorists or whatever you're going up against, that it's a easy way of non-permanently taking them out. They also have lethal rounds. And again, yeah, you can totally kill one of them, but... As this game makes very clear up to that point, death has a very big impact on this game's world. Because if you basically leave the dead guy there for 48 hours, it will cause a void out. There is a... and then later on, all of the firearms then have hermetic rounds, which means, they... use Sam's blood. And you can actually use those either by themselves to sort of like slowly take off damage from like one of the BTs, or you can actually either use one of those or one of the blood grenades that you get to like put this big blood splotch on them, and then you can then take one of the firearms, use one of the regular like lethal rounds, and actually shoot at the blood splotches, and it'll actually take off more hit points from them much quicker. And yes, you can totally kill BTs in this game. It's not easy, obviously, but the rewards is a shitload of those Corellium crystals. By the time I finished this, I had like over 4,000 in stock. So those are definitely good if you're going around repairing like old structures that are falling into disrepair. There is also, the big ones, like, and when you get later on in the game, Chris, you're definitely want to make plenty of these zip lines.
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to want to make those, especially later on in the game when you get into the part where you're basically doing nothing but hiking through mountains. Because what that does, they are probably one of the, probably the best way to travel in that entire game. As long as you build up like a system of them, of relative distance between them, between one point to another, you can literally just ride them from point A to point B and never touch the ground. Yeah.
Do the levels ever mean anything? I keep wondering if that's going to be a thing or not, because
that guy's like already really level more about saying the levels are basically about
just showing progress.
Well, no, the levels are telling you how durable they are up against Timefall.
Well, I mean when your character levels.
Oh, well,
like
that
after
basically
a mission.
Oh, yeah, all that what that means is you are able to keep your balance more, you can carry more cargo. Sometimes it'll actually like give you access to new gear.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a hell of a game. It really is. Obviously I finished it, so I've got Shenmue 3 now. And I don't really have much to add for that one. I only played a little bit of it last night. But it is Shenmue and everything that entails, both positive and negative. Fortunately, it's definitely updated quite a bit. You know, you don't have to deal with like that absolutely god awful control scheme that the first Shenmue had. And to be completely fair, to Yu Suzuki, you know, games were in a really weird time when that game was being developed. So, you know, considering all the stuff he wanted to do in that game, the fact that it has such an utterly bizarre control scheme is understandable.
Yeah, it was kind of a first of its kind, at least on consoles.
Yeah, it was actually one of the first examples of like a fully open world experience.
Yeah, and kind of that they didn't make any more after 2 kind of highlighted how much things evolved after that.
Well, because it eventually became the Yakuza series, and if you've ever played a Yakuza game, yeah. And I also, since, you know, it's fucking free now, I decided to get it. Downloaded Destiny 2. Because as you don't know, Destiny 2 is free to play now. And they've kind of, you know, because of the recent expansion, they've kind of, you know, sort of rebuilt the entire guts of that game. And I want to see, you know, what's changed.
Let me know.
Yeah.
And now it's Black Friday. They put the campaigns Forsaken and Shadowkeep on sale.
Yep.
So you'll play that stuff if you can for
one of the big thing. You know, one of the big things, of course, is that Bungie is no longer under Activision. So I think that might have had a big impact on how they were able to redo this.
Yeah, kind of calling their own shots helps out a lot.
Oh, yeah. I have had people who hated the first two Destinies who have played this new version of Destiny 2 and are like, oh, this is actually pretty good. But anyway, other than that, oh, yeah. You guys ever heard of a little thing called Has-Been Hotel?
Heard of it.
Okay, yeah. So Vivzy Pop, she's been working on this a pilot for this cartoon series called Has-Been Hotel for the last 5 years. And the pilot's now up there on YouTube. You can watch the whole thing. And it is fucking hilarious. Absolutely funny. Just, it's good. It's good. Watch it. It's really funny. The animation is amazing. I have a feeling that this is going to be another one of those cartoons where the fandom is going to become insufferable very soon. Yeah. You know, and considering Friendship is Magic is officially ended, I gotta go somewhere. But yeah, so go watch that if you get a chance. It is absolutely hilarious. They got one of the people from Invader Zim in the voice cast. So, yeah, there's that. They've also got another show coming up soon called Hell of a Boss, and that one's going to have Brandon Rogers in it. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, yep, got to watch that. It actually, I think it comes out early next week, actually. So, yeah, there's that. I'm doing some more stuff on the Reds or Revolutionary Timeline wiki. Once again, I'm going to go ahead and link that here. Specifically, I'm going to link to the wiki itself because it's got a link to the timelines as they're currently being written. Because there's basically like two versions of it. There's the original that was put on alternatehistory.com. There's the rewrite that's going on Sufficient Velocity. And there's the current aspect of the timeline, which is specifically dedicated to its version of World War II. And that one's on alternatehistory.com as well. Also, it's got a link to the Discord server. So, you know. So, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and take that and
put that in the show notes because I forgot to do that last week.
Yeah. If you're an alternate history fan, you're gonna fucking love this. And if you hit the recent changes side and you look over there and you'll see well, I'm actually not on there because I haven't made any major changes in the last few days, but if you see any there that's under the name Adonisus, that's A-D-O-N-I-S-U-S, that's me. Yeah. Basically, it gives like a good like how the it's still very much under construction right now, but we've made a lot of progress. It does a lot about like, you know, it explains specifically the entry on the United Republics itself about how, you know, how it went from the old United States to the modern. The full name of it is known as the North American Union of Socialist Council Republics, but it's usually known as either the Union of American Socialist Republics or the UASR, or more commonly America, or just the United Republics. And basically how it got up to the cold, you know, it started out with the Gilded Age, and then, you know, there's the Workers' Party winning the 1932 presidential election, which scares the living crap out of the bourgeoisie. So Douglas MacArthur conspires with what's that guy's name? I forgot what his name is, but basically, oh, George C. Marshall, to basically kowtow Herbert Hoover into suspending the Constitution, and he ends up leading what's called the MacArthur Push, and that starts the Second American Revolution. Blah 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 blah. There's a lot of stuff that happens, but you'll want to take a look anyway. And I got a old Barnes & Noble gift card that I found that was still usable in my drawer. So I went out to Barnes & Noble, and they were having a bit of a sale. And so I picked up a copy of Risk Legacy. Now, any guys ever played Risk before?
Yeah, it's kind of a fun game.
Yeah. It's, stage your troops, attack, fortify.
Right.
That's basically the whole thing. Very simple, and yet also a lot of fun.
Risk Legacy is basically a game where you got, it's sort of like a sort of semi near future place post World War III. And the difference is that unlike regular Risk, this game actually has mechanics where everything you do affects the game that comes after it. And it's basically built to be like playing 15 games in total. So like, for example, it is possible to like completely take entire sections of the game board out of play because you bomb it too much. Shit like that. Like, you just turn it into a fucking crater and nobody can ever use it again. shit like that. Yeah, that's pretty much it. You guys got anything else you want to add before we move on?
No, I'm good.
Yeah, I wanted to mention the schedule we're going to be streaming for our Twitch. No stream on Saturday or Tuesday. I'll be working late, but Sunday and next Thursday and Friday, I think, are going to be good to go.
Alrighty.
And I'm going to be doing, I think, every Sunday, if I can stream it, play an old game. So I figure I might do something this Sunday, maybe get you on, Phil, to do some shmup stream.
Alright.
Show you a bunch of stuff, especially show you Ride In 5.
Yeah.
And see what the hell that weird-ass game is.
Because it is weird.
Yeah. If you're up for it, Phil.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
Message me and we'll check it out.
Yeah. I'll let you know.
All right. Well, then, it is now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And today we're going to do a little one on Japan again. So, as some of you probably know, Japan is divisive in Southeast Asia for a few different reasons. One of the big ones being that time, you know, they tried to kind of invade and take over all of Southeast Asia into one giant empire. And they, like, did lots of rapes and stuff.
Yeah, that was,
you know, it happened. So as you can imagine, there are still things between Japan and, say, Korea and China, Vietnam, you know, where, everyone's kind of there's still some sticking points, right?
Right.
Some things that they don't like to go over, like, say, you know, the fact that Japan, it still kind of plays really coy when it comes to the rape of Nanking.
Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah. That's not what I'm going to be talking about today. No, specifically, it involves World War II, and well, it kind of involves World War II, even though that wasn't really its purpose. It kind of ended up becoming that because, well, it was it's basically a place where they tend to bury a lot of their war dead. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the place known as the Yasukuni Shrine. Oh yeah. So where to begin? Yasukuni Shrine was originally built and founded in 1869 by the Emperor Meiji himself. It specifically is meant to commemorate those who died in the Boshin War. You guys know what the Boshin War is? Mm-hmm. It's also sometimes called the Japanese Revolution.
Yeah.
It's basically when, like, the imperial system was finally, like, reestablished and the old shogunate system was finally taken apart. And there was a lot of, like, street fighting and shit. If you ever heard of the Shinsengumi, this is the, you know, those guys were, like, hardcore shogunate loyalists. Yeah, they play a part in this. It also, buries people from the First Indochina War of 1946-1954. Yeah! So basically it's now expanded to anybody who dies in wars involving Japan, can be buried there. I say buried there, but they're not actually buried there. Their ashes are interred there because, you know, that's, you know, most people in Japan are cremated, right?
Right.
So you're thinking, okay, so obviously, you know, this has like people who were interred there, who fought in World War II and died. Now,
okay, that, you know, maybe you can have a conversation about that, but that's, like, not too bad, right? I mean, you know, Germany has repudiated Nazism, and yet they still have, like, a lot of the soldiers who fought under Hitler, you know, are more or less interred without very little controversy. Yeah, see, here's the problem. Of the people that are currently interned in there, a good chunk of them are what we know as Class A war criminals.
Shocking.
Yeah. So, as you can probably guess, this involves people like, for example, Hideki Tojo is buried. His ashes are interred there. Let's see. A lot of the people who were involved in Unit 171 are there. You guys have heard of Unit 171, right?
It rings a bell.
They're the guys who took part in human experiments.
Oh.
Okay. On people that were definitely not wanting to.
Okay.
Yeah! Yeah, so there's some other issues, too. For example, the current family that runs the Yasukuni Shrine, they are, I believe, in Japanese terms, they are known as historical revisionists.
Shocking.
In that they tend to deny that the Nanking Massacre never happened, or if it did happen, it wasn't that bad. They also tend to deny the existence of Korean comfort women.
Hmm.
Even though the government actually copped to it?
Yeah! So, amongst the people that are there, there is, of course, Hideki Tojo, Seishiro Itagaki, Heitaro Kamuya, Mora, Kenji Doihara, Akira Muto, Koki Hirota, and Awani Matsui. If you're wondering who those are the guys who were Class A war criminals that were actually executed by hanging. There's also...
Some of those names ring a bell, too.
So. Oh, yeah. Especially Tojo!
Mm-hmm.
Tojo is probably the guy, when most people think of, like, the epitome of Japanese militarism, it's Tojo. Tojo is just the absolute worst. Of course, I would also argue that Hirohito himself has a great deal of responsibility for it as well, but that's another story. Let's see. Also, lifetime imprisonment. They also inter the ashes of Yoshijiro Umizu, Kuniaki Koiso, Hironuma Kichiro, and Toshio Shiratori. It also interns the ashes of Shigenori Togo. And then the two gentlemen who died before their judicial decisions were reached, Osami Nagano and Yosuke Matsuoka. Now, to be fair, it like I said, it also houses the ashes of a lot of people in the Boshin War. So you that includes individuals like Saigo Torimoto. I mean, what's his fucking name? Saigo Takamori. No, actually, he's not buried there because though you don't know who Saigo Takamori is, he's the guy behind the he's one of the guys behind the Satsuma Rebellion. He's the guy who led like the final charge at the Battle of Shirayama. He's actually not buried there, even though he helped build the Meiji Restoration because you know he revolted against the Meiji government afterwards. It does not, however, enshrine the war dead of any shogunate retainers. That includes soldiers of the former shogunate forces, the Yoetsu Refundome. That's the military political coalition that's called the Northern Alliance. And, of course, it also does not house any of the ashes of the Shinsengumi or the Shogatai. So, as you can imagine... The Yasukuni Shrine is a big sticking point for the peoples of China and Korea. Because some of the people that are interned there and their ashes in shrine in honor were people that committed horrific crimes of war against innocent people in both of those countries. And it also doesn't help, again, that the people who kind of run the shrine are just massive fucking assholes about it, you know?
Yeah.
There's also a bunch of memorial statues they have there, including a commemoration statue of a kamikaze pilot, statues honoring war widows with their children, a statue of Omura Masujiro. There's also a commemoration monument to, and this one kind of involves a little explaining, a guy by the name of Justice Radha Hinaman Paul. He was a judge in the Tokyo trials. He was one of the three Asian judges that were there. He was the only one who submitted a judgment which insisted that all the defendants were not guilty. So as you can imagine, the people at the Yasukuni Shrine rather like him. Mm. Yeah, so pretty much over the years, basically every prime minister since World War II has paid their respects to the shrine, including the current one, Shinzo Abe. And every time it happens, both the governments of China and South Korea and North Korea are like, yo, what the fuck? Why'd you do that? Why are you doing that shit? But yeah, so that's the Yasukuni Shrine. It is a massive fucking sticking point in Southeast Asian affairs. So if you ever go to Japan, probably best not to bring it up. Yeah. And that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. Yeah, that shit gets really complicated when World War II gets involved.
Yeah.
In that part of the world. Anyway, so with that, it's now time to move on to the show proper. And as always, we start off with our asshole of the week. And who is our asshole of the week? Why, it's SoCal Gas. Why? Because it turns out that they've been using the money that they've been getting their customers to basically do everything they can to fight any and all climate change action.
Yep. Yeah, so let's see. Some of the funding has come from unknowing customers of Southern California Gas Company.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they are funding, let's see, the Gas Genius, this group that's running the Gas Genius social media accounts, have softly lit images of families and millennials cooking on outdoor grills, enjoying warm baths, and relaxing by roaring fire pits. Will 2020 be the year you upgrade your home to natural gas? Recent caption on the Instagram page for that. Part of a national campaign to highlight the virtues of natural gas, one of the main contributors of global climate change. Mm-hmm. As California and other states make plans to phase out fossil fuels, the campaign is led by American Public Gas Association, a trade group for municipal gas providers, like SoCal Gas. Yeah, they've been charging ratepayers rather than shareholders for some of its contributions to APGA and other gas industry advocacy groups, according to data shared with the Times, is LA Times. That means money paid by SoCal Gas customers and their monthly bills has been used to support groups working to promote natural gas and preserve the gas utility business model. And yeah, they argue that the ratepayer funding is appropriate because it's trying to help the state meet its climate goals, not undermine them. The company funds organizations that provide benefits to our customers, including energy efficiency programs and research that help keep our customers' monthly bills affordable, programs that combat climate change and air pollution from every sector of the economy. Which seems like bullshit.
Mm.
They want to be able to keep charging for gas as long as they can.
Yeah.
Because they want to keep making money.
Yep.
Rather, maybe, I don't know, supporting more electric and green initiatives.
Yeah.
Because that's where the money's going in the future.
Old guys with money, not exactly long-term sighted people.
No. Mm. And also fuck people with fire pits. That shit's just stupid. Make your own fire like a normal person.
Yeah. Rub two sticks together, damn it.
Mm.
Anyway.
Or fuck it, I don't know. Go inside.
Yeah.
Fucking
the outdoors are overrated, goddammit. Yeah.
Mm. Especially as the outdoor becomes more hazardous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For like 9-10 months of the year.
Mm. Yeah. Anyway.
In a state that's usually on fire 2 months of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yep. Yeah. But we do have good news. We have our hero of the week because guess what? Louisiana kept their Democrat governor, John Bel Edwards. He ran re-election in spite of the fact that Trump basically tried to deluge the fucking state with negative ads, which means this is the second election that Trump's camp has lost, has messed with and lost in as many weeks.
Mm. Yep. Managed to get 51% of the vote, so pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, but yeah, it's very much a state that's been Republican for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, to win it, he's very much a moderate Democrat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's still better than Republican.
Well, I mean, look at who was their governor before.
Yeah.
Fucking Bobby Jindal.
Yeah. And they have just some real shitty, like, senators and representatives in the Congress. Like,
well,
is John Kennedy one of them?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he is. But then again, this is Louisiana we're talking about.
Yeah.
And corruption in Louisiana politics is like a ice cream sundae with a cherry on top. It's not complete without the latter.
Yep.
That was a long way to go for a really bad metaphor, but I stuck with it.
Shit happens.
Yeah. Mm. The point is, politics in Louisiana is notoriously corrupt and always has been.
And Louisiana's just had a lot of hard times of late, like the last 10, 15 years with, you know, hurricanes fucking things up big time, causing lots of issues. And as things start getting back to normalcy, you know, having shit like this going on with Republicans trying to, you know, do the shit they do.
As usual.
Especially as people want to move things forward and, like, get rid of the statues, the Confederate statues and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as Louisiana has tons of black people there.
Oh, yes.
Especially New Orleans, which is largely built around black communities.
Black and Vietnamese. Yeah.
Lots of that culture there. So, like, if you're white and you like to party in New Orleans for Mardi Gras, you know, it's not white culture there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, that's – people have been asking, like, is this a preview of coming attractions? Like, is this going to be, like, what's going to happen around this time next year?
I'd like to think so.
I mean, I would, too. I mean,
at least means the states that are red are starting to get less red.
Well, I mean, that's been –
closer and closer, yeah.
Yeah, but, I mean, then again, that's been a long time coming. I mean, people have been talking about the demographic shifts in this part of the country for decades now, and now it's actually starting to happen.
Yeah, it's inching forward in some areas. Others, like Mississippi and Alabama, are, like, fighting like hell to not progress.
But they will eventually change, too. So. Yeah. Because they have to. I mean, it is absolutely, like, inevitable now. It is really only, you know, counting down the days until it actually happens.
Yeah, there are plenty of advocacy groups that are very much fighting for that.
Mm-hmm.
Have been the last, you know, 4 or 5 years at least.
Mm-hmm.
It just takes time to get it going.
Yeah.
Getting people that have been disenfranchised for the last, you know, 30, 40 years, trying to get them back on the train.
Mm. All right. And with that, it is now time to start the proper show proper. And we begin with the impeachment watch. And so it was not a good day for the Trump administration.
Or Republicans in general.
In general.
This whole week.
No, because have you ever watched so many people like – have a psychotic mental breakdown all at the same time? Because that's what this week is.
Yep.
So first things first, we got to bring up probably one of the star witnesses this week was Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who is a
decorated veteran of our armed forces.
I believe he has a Purple Heart.
He has a Purple Heart. He's an immigrant. His dad and his family basically all fled from the Ukraine to the U.S. back in the 80s when they were little kids.
And he's had to endure lots of slander and libel over the last few weeks from Republicans that supposedly love the military.
Yeah. And he kind of established the whole thing at the beginning when Devin Nunes forgot to properly address him, calling him Mr. Vindman. Now, I think in a lot of cases that probably wouldn't have been as big a deal if it weren't for the fact that this was fucking Devin Nunes we're talking about.
Yeah, and there was a big giant sign right in front of him that says Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Yeah.
There's no reason for him to mess that up and properly addressing members of the military.
Mm-hmm.
Especially one so decorated. He worked hard for that title.
Which they apparently support. But you wouldn't know it.
Not enough to be educated about it.
But yeah.
Nunes was basically saying, Mr. Vindman, you testified in your deposition that you did not know the whistleblower. Vindman responds, it's Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's his way of saying, you know, normally this wouldn't bother me, but you're such a massive asshole, I'm going to point it out to you.
Yeah.
So he gave his
test. I think it was also him being like, you guys have been attacking me for weeks.
Yeah, you're going to give me some proper fucking respect.
Yeah.
You know, this Purple Heart means something, motherfucker.
Yeah. And I think he still has shrapnel inside his body, too.
Yep, he does. So basically the four sort of – we had – okay, so we essentially had, I think it was seven people that testified this week. Now, the Monday and Tuesday, we had, of course, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. We also had, let's see, we had
Jennifer Williams.
Jennifer Williams.
Mike Pence's aide.
Yeah.
Kurt Volker, former U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine, and Tim Morrison, former National Security Council aide.
Mm-hmm.
And those last two were Republican picked.
Yeah, that's the fun part. People.
And yeah, they very much were not going in for the Republican agenda.
No, it's like, guys, this shit happened. I'm not going to fucking lie to you people.
Yeah. Morrison said he never asked his Ukrainian counterparts to investigate the Bidens because it was not a policy objective.
Yeah.
Volker said the U.S. is not pushing back hard enough on Russia, and we owe Ukraine a great deal of support when talking about why Ukraine is important. Mm-hmm. Morrison and Volker were the GOP's witnesses. Yeah, there were witnesses Republicans requested when they started this inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, their testimony was not flattering to Trump.
No, it was not.
Yeah, they described their unease at Rudy Giuliani's efforts in Ukraine and their skeptical view of efforts to launch an investigation into Burisma, mm-hmm. the Ukrainian energy company that is kind of at the center of the Republicans' conspiracy involving Ukraine.
Yep.
Volker admitted that he drew a sharp distinction between Burisma and Biden, but admits that he was wrong to view them separately. In hindsight, I now understand that others saw the idea of investigating possible corruption involving the Ukrainian company Burisma as equivalent to investigating former Vice President Biden. I saw them as very different, the former being appropriate and unremarkable, the latter being unacceptable. Volker said in his opening statement, in retrospect, I should have seen that connection differently. And had I done so, I would have raised my own objections. So we're talking about the previous testimony he gave in the private inquiries and that he kind of had a change of heart since then, especially now that it's going to be like on the record, what he was saying. But yeah, for Vindman and Jennifer Williams, they were very conscious of revealing information improperly and inviting retribution. There were times that I think Nunes and some of the others were trying to bait Vindman into revealing the whistleblower. And Schiff stepped in and was like, be careful with what you're doing here. Because it doesn't pertain to the testimony that they need to be giving. And so just sort of be careful with that stuff. Is that the July 25th call between Trump and the Ukrainian leader? It's not perfect. The president was acting on his own in July in the July call asking for investigations was provided with no talking points to back that up.
Mm-hmm.
Vindman described a July 10th meeting in which there was demand in the White House of a direct quid pro quo by Ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland. Republicans questioned Vindman's integrity. They suggest there was mixed loyalty because Ukraine offered him a government position. Vindman turned it down. They also suggest he inflated his position. Yeah, that was definitely a thing. Like, he got offered a position in Ukraine, but he was very much like, I turned it down every single time and reported it to his superiors, sort of thing. Very much, you know, saying I did everything that I was supposed to do. But they kept harping on that as like somehow trying to question his loyalty as somebody who's been in the U.S. since he was a baby. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you guys are working really hard to try to discredit a decade.
They have to because they know that the case is against them and the facts are against them. So they have to do everything possible to muddle the narrative.
Yeah, which I do. Jim Jordan just yelling all the time.
Yeah.
Which people are like, you know, it would have been interesting if he was this concerned with the kid wrestlers at Ohio State when he was there. Then
who were totally getting diddled, and he knew about it and didn't tell anyone. So
sexually harassed and abused.
Yeah.
I kind of wish somebody had brought that up, but obviously that wouldn't really happen on this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody on Twitter made sure to let him know.
Oh, yeah.
As best they could.
Oh, he is going to keep hearing that until the day he dies. He's going to carry it to his grave. But we weren't through this week because then we had Mr. Gordon Sondland. Gordon Sondland is ambassador to, I believe, the ambassador to the Ukraine.
EU.
To the EU. He's ambassador to the European Union. He's actually a pretty big Trump fan. I mean, he gave $1 million to Trump's campaign.
Yeah, you don't do that without being on board.
Yeah. And basically
bought his way to that seat.
Yeah. And he was probably the biggest fucking mistake that the Republicans made because they thought he was going to be like their slam dunk. He went in there and basically implicated the entire Trump administration.
And also kind of implicated himself as being not qualified for this role.
Yeah.
That he had.
Mm-hmm. But basically the big bombshell he said is it's simple, a few words. We were acting under the president's orders.
Yep. Talking about how they did not want to work with Giuliani.
Mm-hmm.
But they were, you know, having to deal with it because he was forced upon them.
Mm-hmm.
By the president.
Yeah, he ended up implicating not just Trump and Giuliani. He also ended up implicating Vice President Mike Pence, Mike Pompeo, and Mick Mulvaney. Basically, he said everyone in the State Department was aware that there was a quid pro quo. Pompeo was actually directing Kurt Volker to communicate with Giuliani even as late as September 24 of this year. Yeah. And they kept trying to drag the Bidens back into it and just fucking failing because.
Yeah. The cavalcade of incompetence on display this week was amazing.
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Mm.
Pretty much. And then finally, the last things we had gave their testimony. It was, what was it, Katie Hill? It was Katie Hill and David Holmes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, David Holmes, he's based now in Kiev. Fiona Hill, that's the other one, who was the former leading advisor on Russian affairs for President Trump. They both got there for six. They testified for, I think it was like a combined 6 hours. And basically, first things first, Fiona Hill basically took that conspiracy theory that the GOP's been sort of saying that, you know, the Ukraine are the ones that are actually behind all of this. And she's like, no, it's the Russians. It was always the Russians.
Yeah.
She gives details. Even gives color about the Trump Sondland call, including, you know, when Sondland told Trump that he loves your ass, that weird shit. Trump asking, is he going to do the investigation? Sondland answering, oh yeah, he's going to do it. He'll do anything you ask. And it, apparently it's now come to light that you've been noticing why all of these testimonies have been starting to sound alike. Part of the strategy, redundancy, because Democrats are trying to remind people, okay, this is the shit that's going down. You all keeping notes here? Because we don't want y'all to forget this.
Yep.
Also, neither Adam Schiff or the Democrats, they're not waiting for the courts on this one. Basically saying we cannot be at the mercy of the court. Now you got to ask yourself, well, where are we going after this now? For the record, Schiff has not ruled out any more inquiries in the near future. But there's also been signs that they might be starting to wrap it up. It's been announced that they want to have the actual impeachment vote before Christmas. So we'll see.
Basically, this was like a very devastating week for the GOP as far as their side of this whole thing.
Yeah, and you could see it on Devin Nunes' face after Sondland gave his testimony because, I mean, he knew, he's like, I am so fucked.
Yeah. And if you don't remember, he is also suing a Twitter account called Devin Nunes' Cow.
He's also recently came to light that he had been working in the past with one of Giuliani's henchmen.
Yeah.
One of the guys that was arrested.
Yeah, one of the Ukrainian guys he was working with.
Yep. Which means he might actually be implicated in this as well.
I mean, he is the guy that's, I think when they finished with one of the security meetings in the house, he ran to the White House to inform the Trump administration about what was going on, what he just found out. It's like he's not exactly a guy that is good at hiding his conflicts of interest.
Or he's phenomenally stupid. I'm honestly not sure which is which.
Yeah.
Well, you can be both.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It might be a combo of the two. So yeah, that was the impeachment watch for this week. Man, what is next week going to bring? I have no idea.
Well, it's a break at least because Thanksgiving is going to be going on. Mm-hmm. So people are going to be at least out for a bit.
Yeah.
Oh, the dinner table discussions.
Oh God. Oh, don't fucking remind me. Oh God. Oh shit. I think you may have just got me to have a panic attack.
Now, just remember the three words, arm the poor.
Yeah. Arm the poor, eat the rich.
Yeah. Only one thing they're very good for.
Yeah. And study Chairman Mao. But, yeah. Those are the key three words there. So, for those of you who want to know, we had the new Democratic debates in Atlanta this week, yeah, in my part of the woods. And amongst the things that came out of that is, amongst other things, the fact that even though Bernie Sanders is a front runner, the mainstream press is still treating him like he's some kind of outsider. Pete Buttigieg is actually kind of eking closer to the front now. And Joe Biden is still stuck in the 60s or 70s.
Yeah.
And I mean the 1860s and 70s.
Yeah.
Joe Biden said this week that if he won the presidency, he would not legalize marijuana because it is a, quote, gateway drug.
In other news, Joe Biden has just ensured that he does not win the presidency in 2020.
Yep. Oh.
Yeah, he says there's not enough evidence as to whether or not it is a gateway drug.
Yeah.
It's like it's been around long enough.
Yeah.
There's not really a lot of studies that say it isn't.
Yeah.
We've got plenty of scientific work to go on showing that that's not how it works.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, man, that 80s Reaganite brainwashing is hard to get over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He still supports the states doing their stuff, but that's not really saying much.
No. Because eventually all of the states are going to legalize it.
Yeah.
It'll still be criminalized federally.
Mm-hmm.
In a weird way, like you can't take it across state lines, at least without good ways of hiding it.
Mm. Yeah.
But yeah, trying to...
Well, there's no state border checks, so
mm-hmm.
at least you got that.
Yeah.
Yeah, unless you get lucky, unlucky.
Mm.
Yeah, you can't, like, order it online. Do we deliver it from a different state or anything like that?
Yeah.
Can't take it on you onto the plane or anything like that. So, you know, lots of ways of going through checks between states.
Mm. Yeah.
That aren't just on the road.
Yeah.
Also, it makes it a lot harder if you're black.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because you're just automatically a fucking target.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that marijuana is very dangerous.
Yeah. It
could kill many cops if you're not careful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, next up. Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, was indicted on bribery, fraud, and breach of trust charges this week. I hope they lock the fucker up and throw away the goddamn key.
Yeah.
Bullets are cheaper.
Yeah, that too.
Actually, you know what? Just cover him in honey and leave him out in the middle of the desert.
Nice. Go old school.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Oh, yeah. And did you know that he's been, because now that these charges have gone public, he's started using a very familiar strategy.
Mm-hmm.
He's been calling it all conspiracy and fake news.
Oh, yeah. That's going really well for Trump these days.
Oh, yeah.
The playbook of the tyrant. Unfortunately, it's not working, folks.
No.
For you know that to work... your populists have to be complete morons. And thankfully, the majority of Americans are not stupid. I think these people are, like, grossly underestimating the intelligence of the American populace at this point. Yeah.
Yeah,
Trump did get in.
Yeah, but he kind of did it on a technicality.
Yeah, and you know the old saying, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on you.
Shame on. The fool can't get fooled again.
Yeah.
Have you seen the witch hunt shirt that Trump sells on his site?
No, yeah. And I would care not to.
Yeah.
It's hilarious because it portrays, I think, Adam Schiff, Nancy Pelosi, and... somebody else as the witches doing the witch hunt.
Like, that's not how that works.
That doesn't work that way.
It doesn't make any sense other than the part where it says stop the witch hunt and Trump is designed like a superhero flying, holding an American flag, which you can't
fly. You know what? Fuck it. I'm going to go look up this shirt because I have a feeling who might have been behind the artwork on. I have a sneaking suspicion on who is behind the artwork on this shirt.
Yeah.
I'm just getting a gray square.
I might have posted that twice there. Okay.
Yeah, you did. I can see it.
There you go. Nope, that's again.
Hold on. Don't worry about it. Doubling. I can just...
For the reason it's doubling it when I try and paste it, I don't know why.
Yeah, hold on. I got it. Okay.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I got it here. But, yeah. Yeah, I think that's a Ben Garrison drawing.
Wrong one.
But anyway. All right. Speaking of people who are super idiots, the state of South Dakota put out their new anti-meth campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it has a series of posters of people on it. Just says meth, I'm on it.
I bet they are.
There's an old cowboy farm guy. There's like a black like college student.
There's a couple of what looks like high school football players.
And a woman sitting in a field.
Well, I think might be a native.
No, it's maybe. Really for everybody.
Wow.
Yeah. I was like, Matt, yeah. I'm on it.
Yeah.
That's...
That's an advertisement.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially because it's been proven that the campaigns that are all anti-drug do not really work.
No, they basically increase drug use.
Yeah, this is a $1.4 million ad campaign contracted by the state's Department of Social Services to a Minneapolis marketing firm, which pissed off one of the major marketing firms in South Dakota. It's like, what? Why couldn't we get this fucking job? Which will use various forms of media to educate every person across the state of South Dakota on meth addiction, resources available, and strategies to engage communities in recovery. For that amount of money and the importance of the subject matter, there should be scrutiny upon those who signed off on the premise. Someone listened to a boardroom pitch that most Americans found harebrained and decided to invest state funds to embrace the I'm on meth mantra. And yeah, the governor, Kristi Noem, is the one that ultimately approved this. And obviously has become a big favorite of the internet to mock.
Yeah, it's so easy.
You know, before you do any of these campaigns, there really is just one simple thing that you need to do. Hire a random 13-year-old to look at your pitch, and if they start snickering, go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, it's not that hard.
Yeah, and I basically, I believe from one of the other articles they wrote related to this, is basically that other businesses are just taking the same ad campaign, just adapting it for their own stuff. So there's like a biking company called Spoken Sport Bikes has an ad that says bikes, we're on it.
So it was a copy and paste ad campaign.
Sturgis Buffalo Chip says motorcycles, we're on them.
Mm-hmm.
Natural Light, we're on it. You know, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah.
Especially the ones that just have an outline or the background is the state of South Dakota. Just says,
yeah. Meth. We're on it.
Yeah. It's like, okay, you guys paid $1.4 million to inspire a bunch of these other companies to make joke campaigns referencing yours. Yeah.
You basically just helped Spencer Gifts for their next stock.
You spent $1.4 million to create new memes for the internet.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
And other businesses.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, the governor of California has appealed to Altitude Sports and Entertainment to get their television deals done and finalized. And Altitude responded in kind by suing Comcast.
Yeah, this is probably going to be one of those, yeah, don't do it like that moments.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is Jared Polis, governor of Colorado, sent an open letter to Jim Martin over at Altitude Sports and Entertainment, which is the basically the on-screen home for – or the on-cable slash satellite home for all Denver sports, major professional sports.
Mm-hmm.
And over the summer, pretty much all of their agreements with cable and satellite providers expired, and it took quite a while for the first one to get done with CenturyLink, and then we were well into the NHL season when DirecTV got done, and Comcast and Dish Network are still holding out. And so after the governor leaned on Altitude to get their deals done, they turned around and launched an antitrust suit against Comcast. So,
which I can get behind.
So, yeah. If you're in the Denver area and you want to watch your Avalanche hockey or Denver Nuggets basketball, yeah, you're probably gonna want to pick up DirecTV or CenturyLink, because it doesn't look like it's going to happen on Comcast in the near future.
Yeah. Although, if I'm Altitude at this point, I'm starting to build out my streaming service in the background.
Oh, yeah. There was actually a rumor that they were going to look into possibly doing something with Amazon, but that never materialized as a couple of TV deals did.
Yeah. Because honestly, I think the whole TV sports like heyday is probably on the wane. I mean, the NFL has a lock on just about every major like cable provider at this point. And it's not that it's basically like them being frozen out. So doing stuff like, you know, their own streaming services is probably a better way to go long term.
Yeah.
But what do I know?
All right.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting watching this play out. They're saying that the antitrust suit that Comcast, quote, wants to extinguish competition from Altitude, and are setting financial terms that make no economic sense unless Comcast's aim is to use its monopsony power to eliminate Altitude so that Comcast will control sports programming in Colorado, Nebraska, and Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Next up, Chick-fil-A has announced that they are kind of ending all current donations to the various anti-LGBT groups that they have been notorious donating to, but also kind of not, kind of complicated.
Yeah, they're not categorically eliminating donations to such organizations.
No.
And they aren't ruling out supporting such organizations in the future. And in addition to that, they have a couple of in-house foundations that pretty much do the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Basically what they announced is that they're just not donating to the companies that they're doing right now, just kind of announcing a new swap of companies that they're doing.
To some other ones instead.
They satisfied the terms of their existing contracts, and now they're going to sign some new ones elsewhere.
This took over the internet, like people like, oh, they're stopping doing this. They're not doing this anymore. It's like, no, they're not.
Yeah, you got to wait and see. And
they're just not donating specifically to the Salvation Army or Fellowship of Christian Athletes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doesn't mean they're not supporting any others.
Yeah.
Or can even I just these say, fuck the Salvation Army.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Just with the absolute most utmost force. Mm. Yeah. Because not only is the Salvation Army anti-LGBT, they've been one of the biggest roadblocks to progress in over the last 100 years.
Hmm.
Look, there's a reason why the Wobblies used to call them the Starvation Army.
Hmm.
Because they're not really interested in helping anyone, helping improve anyone's situation.
Hmm.
It's basically a carrot and stick thing for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a shame they're very much a big part of the culture in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically they'll probably start showing up around stores in the next couple weeks here.
Mm-hmm.
They're a big part of the NFL's Thanksgiving games. Athletes have done touchdown celebrations around the big cauldron they have out there, that sort of stuff. It's this ain't a great look for a league that wants to be pro-LGBT.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because these people, basically, if they find out anybody that's working for them is LGBT, they'll fire them.
Yep.
Or harass them to get them to quit, whatever works best for them.
Yeah.
They don't want to support anybody that is LGBT.
Because it's not Christian.
Because Eric, he didn't like helping everybody.
Nope.
That's not why he died.
No. Next up. So
I saw this coming.
Oh yeah, let's be honest, we all did. So as you guys probably know, Burger King has been making bank on the Impossible Whopper recently. And has pretty much changed the game in fast food a good deal, because now all the other big burger chains are trying to come out with their own version.
Yep.
And I've tried one, and they're good.
Yeah.
I mean, they're nothing special, but that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
And unless somebody told you, you wouldn't really know the difference.
Yeah. It's like you can eat one, and it tastes like a burger. And it's
And you would never know that it was completely beef-free.
Mm.
But there's also the fact that, you know, even though the Impossible Whopper itself is not made out of meat, they'll still cook it on the stuff that cooks the meat. And because of that, a vegan has recently opened a lawsuit against Burger King over the fact that the Impossible Whopper is being cooked on their regular broilers.
I don't see this being a case. I've not seen any advertisement whatsoever that claims that the Impossible Whopper is vegan.
No. Well, it has cheese in it, which automatically makes it not vegan.
Hmm. Yeah, though the base one does not come with it, but there's always the fine print that's on their ads. It's like, if you do not want this cooked on the broilers that we do our regular patties, just let us know.
Yeah.
We'll cook it in the microwave or whatever they do.
And I'm guessing this asshole didn't know that.
Hmm.
No. Why would he?
No, he's vegan. He's not
vegan.
Not supposed.
He's got to make sure everybody knows that.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I saw plenty of people on Twitter like, this is why people have bad opinions of vegans. Let's see. Yeah, they have some tweets here. Somebody saying the caution to vegetarians and vegans: Burger King's Impossible Whoppers cooked on the same broilers beef patties, so there's cross contamination. You can ask for it to be microwaved instead. It's up on the sites. I think people are saying it's been there since the start. But yeah, they're doing a class action lawsuit involving this.
They're going to get laughed out of court.
Oh yeah,
they're
going to get laughed out of court.
Yeah, they'll be just like, it's right here on the site, and any other information they have about the Whopper, the Impossible Whopper.
Yeah. All right, and next up, oh man, this story is fucking. this one's going to require a bit of explaining. Okay, so anybody who has been a fan of manga and anime or light novels or just Japanese pop culture for a while knows that the Japanese approach to sexuality is both very earthy but also kind of convoluted at the same time.
And far-reaching.
Yeah, and far-reaching. So back in the day, especially like back around the 60s and 70s, you really could not draw a penis or a vagina like at all. The best you could do is you could have something that might vaguely resemble like a white out shadow of a penis, and usually having something that would be like symbolic. Like, say, like an eggplant or a mushroom, or you're like, you know, one of those like logs ringing a temple bell, you know, something like that. Then they started to kind of let up in the 80s. So then it got so like you could actually draw the outline of a penis. And vaginas could be, you could kind of draw them, but you had to make sure they didn't have any pubic hair. So, you know, you could draw like, you know, the labia and the folds, but you couldn't draw the pubic hair. Which I think some people believe is how the whole lolicon thing kind of accidentally got started.
Well, that certainly didn't help.
Then in the early 90s, there was this guy named, I forgot what his name. His name was Miyazaki. He was a serial killer who... Satomu Miyazaki, who killed a bunch of young girls. Then they found out that he was like into really hardcore pornographic manga. And basically the whole industry had a fucking freak out.
And they laid it at otaku culture's feet.
Yeah. And so what happened is they started the infamous censor bars and the infamous
mosaics.
And the way – because Japan's law, like most of Asia, laws there are more of a suggestion or a guideline than like a solid set of rules. They've been sort of playing this cat and mouse game with the Japanese government for years now. So,
and there were attempted prosecutions.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think the most recent was actually in 2004.
About right.
Yeah, there was this manga that was published by this artist named Beauty Hair. It was called Mishitsu Honey Room.
It was actually declared obscene, and the publisher was actually, he went to jail over it. I'm actually looking at some of the artwork now. It's actually not bad. But apparently it was too realistic for the censorship board standards. So, yeah. And so basically now, if you see Japanese porn of any kind now, if it's drawn, normally you'll see maybe the thinnest bit of a censor bar over maybe part of the vagina or like the crown of the head of the penis, maybe. And if you're watching, like, you know, live porn, it's basically mosaics out the wazoo, right?
Pretty
Keep
much.
In mind that, you know, in this industry, in the Japanese porn industry, it's perfectly fine having women sucking off a dog or, you know, pooping on each other. But God forbid you show a bit of pubic hair. It's that kind of weird.
And then compounding this is that the censorship laws actually were written in such a way where they started encroaching on mainstream manga and anime.
Yes, they did. And as you can imagine, the industry did not take kindly to that. So back in 2014, part of the Japanese Diet sort of founded a coalition basically based around the anime, manga, light novel, and gaming industry. And one of those was a gentleman by the name of Yamada Taro. And he's the subject of this story here. Because this week, he and a group of other politicians introduced a bill that would actually challenge and roll back the old criminal code 175, which means that hentai and pornography would no longer need to be censored in this manner.
Which would, in, on one hand, it would bring that industry in line with pretty much the rest of the world, and it would also get the manga and anime industries out from under some of the, call them, collateral restrictions.
Yeah. So, yeah, yeah, and if this does go through, I mean, it's going to have fucking ripple effects.
Yeah, like, it's going to be one of the definitive cultural adjustments of the Reiwa period.
Mm-hmm. And, but the flip side of this might also mean that if you end up accidentally selling this material to someone who's underage, you might be under legal liabilities. I mean, it doesn't explicitly say that here, but let's be honest, that's
coming. Yeah, that's they're going to have to find ways to safeguard it for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of how it is pretty much in the rest of the world anyway, so
yeah,
it's not like this is an unsolvable problem.
They can definitely learn elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, we'll see how that works out.
I think, in a way, it actually would, if this gets repealed, it would be very freeing for a lot of artists to, you know, just finally be able to do the kind of work that they wanted to do.
Yeah, it's true, but you also have to remember, Japan is not free of moral guardians.
Yeah, there
especially
are
especially if it's the Parents Teacher Association, who are like the number one fucking thorn in the side of all of these publishers.
Yeah, they're going to lobby hard against this bill.
Yeah.
And you've also
there's going to be books that are going to get burned.
Conservatives,
yeah.
That are going to pretty much declare war.
Yeah.
Not to mention your censorship boards that are going to panic for lack of anything to do to keep them in business.
Yeah. Also, you mentioned that thing, though. It's going to be weird because you brought up, like, the traditional conservatives. That also includes people like, you know, Shinzo Abe and, yep. You know,
who ironically is from the same party as Yamada.
Yeah, the Liberal Democratic Party, which, for the record, that's...
It's neither.
It's neither. It's a very conservative party.
So how did Yamada get tied up with them?
Oh, because he's the otaku politician. That's what he's famous for.
So he's also...
He actually rode his seat into the Japanese Diet by specifically appealing to otaku voters.
Well, no, I understand that, but if he's introducing bills like this, how does he fit in with a more conservative party?
Well, the thing about Japan is that it's basically been a one-party state in all but name since the Republic of Japan officially began.
So the party affiliation doesn't really mean much.
No, basically the LDP has sort of, because of the way Japanese politics operates, it's sort of inadvertently become a big tent party.
Hmm.
Consider the fact that the biggest like opposition party that they have in the Japanese Diet is the Communist Party of Japan. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And by the way, as far as the actual Communist Party of Japan goes with this stuff, there's like the women's wing of their party that has some issues with the way that the industry runs itself and portrays women.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
And let's be honest, it's
well-founded.
They're not wrong.
No.
So, you know, whether will they be able to balance that with this appeal to free speech? You know, it's going to be – we'll see. We'll see.
This is going to be a story to follow.
Yeah, we'll see how all this goes. All right, so moving on from there. Over in – I think this is in – yeah, this is in Kansas City. Nick Vazos, who is the traffic reporter for this particular station in Kansas City – was apparently not feeling very well, so he decided that he was going to call out sick. And he's like, okay, so what was he going to do? He was going to email and say, look, guys, sorry, I'm not feeling under the weather. What he didn't do, though, was he accidentally managed to send his out sick message to everyone in the Nexstar media group.
Yeah, to their breaking news list.
Yep.
Everybody on there.
At least
they
also made it to the right place.
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically what happened is people from the various stations across the country started replying and sending things like and people started posting – the work there started posting all over Twitter saying – getting the hashtag get well Nick. Mm-hmm. Or no, best – what is it? I think prayers for Nick. Trending. So people posting replies to this list saying like WKRG is sending you good Gulf Coast vibes, thoughts and prayers, feel better Nick, you're in our thoughts, from your friends in Vegas, get better bud, from Greenville, North Carolina, bunch of stuff like that, as well as just posting their own messages on Twitter with the hashtag prayers for Nick. So everybody just kind of got in on the fun.
Mm-hmm.
Something to, you know, spice up a boring day, it seemed like. But eventually, the Nexstar people that are sort of managing these lists had to send on a message and basically lock this whole chain, saying, mm-hmm. I hate to be a party pooper, and I have as much sympathy for Nick as anyone, but with the number of members of the breaking news list, there could be thousands of emails sent by the time this is done. Mm-hmm. We've locked the list down so that no one can send to it. Please refrain from applying all to any of the messages containing the news, all station breaking news alert group. We need to restore the ability for users to send to the list very soon in the event that a breaking news event were to occur. Yeah. Thanks for your understanding. Which the employee that posted this on Twitter said they can take away our emails, but they can't take away our hashtag prayers for Nick.
Which is true.
Yep, and just even the accounts for the station itself were doing the same thing, sending out prayers for Nick hashtag email tweets. So yeah, one of those days where like a bunch of news people basically got together and had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
And Nick,
get well soon, Nick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, we got a Florida story for you. So, has anybody had, like, known anybody who has a car that, like, just automatically just started, like, is just stuck in, like, doing donut wheels without anybody actually driving it?
No, that's never happened to me.
Yeah, it does happen on occasion. And unfortunately, it just so happened to happen to a little dog. In Florida,
a little dog.
Well, it was a chocolate Labrador, which is definitely not little.
They're enormous animals. But anyway, a Florida dog put a car into reverse and basically did donuts in a cul-de-sac for nearly an hour.
In Port St. Lucie, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And dog hopped into its owner's running car, kicked it in reverse, and drove in circles for an hour. Luckily, this is a cul-de-sac where it's just this whole circular street, so it was just kind of backing up slowly for an hour, and nobody got hurt. I think it just hit a mailbox, one of the neighbor's mailboxes, used up a bunch of gas, and just got a lot of attention from neighbors, as well as they called the cops and firemen and all that over. I think eventually when it hit the mailbox, it started slowing down. They managed to get the get to the door and get it unlocked.
Hmm.
So they could stop it and get the dog out.
Hmm.
Yeah, you can see the video of it sort of happening. And yeah, it's one thing is kind of funny just for the fact nothing really happened.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, the dog's owner, who asked to remain anonymous, had left his car running in the street when the dog changed gears and didn't stop driving for almost an hour. The community escaped injuries, save for the mailbox, which the dog's owner promised to fix. As for the pup, it's impossible to know its thoughts behind the wheel. Did it jump a chance for a joyride or fleeting taste of freedom? Or was it a harrowing accident as the dog felt all control slip through its paws? And yeah, the person that sort of reported this story to the news, Ann Sable, basically said they should give that thing a license.
Well, I've seen some people drive, so yeah.
Yeah, lay away. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just saying. I've seen how some people drive. I think this dog would probably actually be better than a lot of those people.
Probably.
Man,
all right.
Now for general, terrible at backing up.
Yeah. All right. Next up, NASA. We got a NASA story. NASA has been doing a study that I think concluded this week, and what it did is it resulted in the first global geologic map of the largest moon that Saturn has, which is Titan. And it's awesome. Look at it.
Yeah, and it kind of reveals that Titan is not too dissimilar to Earth.
No.
Methane atmosphere, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, has a dynamic world full of dunes, lakes, plains, craters, and other terrains. It's the only planetary body in the solar system other than Earth known to have stable liquid on its surface. But instead of water raining down from clouds and filling lakes and seas on Earth, what rains down is methane and ethane. Mm-hmm. Hydrocarbons that we think of as gases, but that behave as liquids in Titan's frigid climate.
Right.
Yeah, Titan has an active methane-based hydrologic cycle that has shaped a complex geologic landscape, making its surface one of the most geologically diverse in the system. Despite the different materials, temperatures, and gravity fields between Earth and Titan, many surfaces feature are similar between the two worlds and can be interpreted as being products of the same geologic processes. The map shows that the different geologic terrains have a clear distribution with latitude globally, and that some terrains cover far more area than others.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was done with the team led by Rosalie Lopez, a planetary mm-hmm. geologist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Her team worked with fellow planetary geologist David Williams of the School of Earth and Science or Space Exploration at Arizona State, which they used data from the Cassini mission, the satellite that went around Saturn, did 120 flybys of the Mercury-sized moon. And they used the radar imager to penetrate Titan's opaque atmosphere of nitrogen and methane. In addition, the team used data from Cassini's visible and infrared instruments, which were able to capture some of Titan's larger geologic features through the methane haze. Hmm. So yeah, it's a pretty cool kind of map they put together for this whole thing.
Yeah. So, do you think it could anything actually could live on there?
Mm, not without a suit.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
Anything human.
Yeah.
But people are looking at, I think, Europa.
Mm-hmm.
which is a planet that has, it's still cold and icy, but it has big oceans under the ice.
Hmm. Yeah.
That people are very much interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Could be, so if there is something underneath it, Europa, in there, it'll probably look something vaguely like what we had during the Cambrian Age.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of, like, weird water bugs and fish that are also plants. Hmm. And plants that are also weird water bugs and fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, or it'll be like the movie Europa Report.
Yeah.
Or not.
Or not. Anyway, next up, Tesla. Tesla revealed their Cybertruck this week. And, yeah, it kind of bombed. Yeah, when you say that your vehicle is bulletproof and then you try to shoot it and it shatters the fucking glass.
Yeah.
Womp, womp.
Who thought this was a good idea?
Elon Musk.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, this is very much a... It's a weird design for a truck, too, because it's basically like futuristic sci-fi looking, the way you see in a lot of like sci-fi art.
Yep.
But obviously nobody tries to make that an actual vehicle, where it's kind of like a giant triangle, a pyramid kind of triangle kind of thing, where it just has both ends kind of go up at a slope and meets up at the top. I guess it's all kind of glass top, so no real, like, top of this car is kind of always just moonroof looking kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a real weird vehicle, and people are just like, this looks like a car from the PS1. People make on the PS1 game.
There are also Warthog comparisons.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if Halo was a PS1 game, I guess. I saw some developer, like, remake the whole thing in... whatever engine they were using, and said it was about 103 pixels, polygons. Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, I like minimalism in design. This is a little too much minimalism.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially for a truck.
It looks way too military. Like, yeah, it really does.
Probably where the Warthog comparisons are coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like it's there to... serve as sort of an APC.
Hmm.
Yeah, and so today, after the reveal, Tesla stock started sinking about 6%.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jim Cramer on Mad Money was talking about this, saying since Musk announced it, the stock is up 37 points from $317. Cybertruck, seems stillborn. Would you look at it? Look, there's no accounting for taste. Maybe some people like the look of it, but I think what's really important, and Phil LeBeau went over this, it's just not going to dent the Ford, GM, Chrysler, Dodge, Hammerlock on the best part of the entire market.
Hmm.
I just think it's going to be a bit of a bust. I'm calling it the Edsel, the E-Edsel. That's my name for it. I look at this thing, and I do think there is a DeLorean aspect to it. That was a niche product. I think that the trick to trucks is that they all look like each other. That's what people want. This does not look like anything. Which is not wrong, like, trucks generally have the same kind of shape.
Yeah.
Yeah, shape and look to it.
Keep in mind, though, this is Jim Cramer we're talking about. Mm. And, you know, the guy who, like, breathlessly said that there was no housing crisis coming right up to the moment that it happened.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, he's an entertainment show, but...
Mm. I mean, yeah, the way I look at it, I've seen the pictures of it, and it doesn't really look like a truck. It kind of does, but I'm just kind of wondering how well it would serve.
It wasn't until I saw
purpose.
Them showing off their electric ATV and driving it into the bed of the truck. I was like, oh shit, there is a truck bed there.
Yeah.
Because it just isn't designed in a way that makes you aware that that's a thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's like a back end of it that is a truck bed.
Yeah.
It just looks like a giant car. But somehow there's a truck bed in there.
Mm.
It's not even like a Camino or something like that, where it's like has this.
Yeah, it's a stealth Camino.
Back half bit that, yeah, it's a $40,000 Camino.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I don't know. I'm not the. I think the market reaction to this is probably a bit much.
Yeah.
I mean, trucks have like you know, Kramer says all trucks like look like each other, but maybe that's the problem.
Yeah.
Maybe. But there's also very much a specific audience for that.
Yeah.
And this isn't going to convince them to go their route, I don't think. No. This design is for people that probably don't normally have trucks.
Yeah.
Maybe want one, but hasn't, I don't know, need something to set it apart, I guess, from the others. I imagine all those companies are working on their own electric trucks if they don't already have them.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So even that's not necessarily going to be a huge differentiating point in the next few years.
Yeah. I just think the automotive industry as a whole is going crazy right now. You've got this coming from Tesla. You've got the new Mustang is a hybrid SUV for some reason.
Yeah. I saw people like freaking out that are just big fans of Mustangs, which is always weird when I see people are like fanboys of specific models of cars.
What a weird car to obsess about.
Yeah.
Well, Mustang's like one of those classic American cars.
Yeah.
But the notion that you get bent out of shape over the Mustang, I forget what they called it. Mustang something. I forget what it was. But I looked at it and I was like, yeah, it doesn't look like a Mustang.
Yeah.
They're just using that branding to make it more appealing, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like one of those hybrid car SUV kind of things.
Yeah. That's kind of what it looks like. Generic, just a hybrid SUV.
Yeah. Anyway,
companies are just aren't at the point where they're kind of like, we need to move towards electric because that's going to be the thing that people are going to be able to do for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And they're trying to find a path that's, you know, eases off the gas cars and towards the electric and get the style there so that people don't freak out too much like they do when you reveal something called the Cybertruck.
Cybertruck.
Yeah, whoever came up with that should be shot.
Yes.
That's probably Musk. That's very much like something a nerd would come up with.
Yeah.
But also, car names are stupid anyway. There's some that have like Native American names, and it's like, that does not compute with the car.
Yeah.
Oh.
Something that pollutes a lot, name it after, you know, a Native American name. It's just, it feels like car names are at that point where they're just looking up synonyms or Wikipedia to find weird nouns or names of things because they've exhausted all the Greek names and animals and all this.
Yeah. Now they're just naming them after, now they're just like numbering them at this point.
I do think a lot of marketing departments do that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. At least Tesla is just like, it's the Tesla 3, Tesla X, or now it's the Tesla Cybertruck.
Yeah. Mm. Well, the 3 was supposed to be the E, but...
Yeah. Mm. They're kind of treating it like phones, essentially, where just numbering it, maybe having some different names. It's just weird.
Yeah.
And now, finally, for the entertainment part of the show. First and foremost, Zack Snyder and the stars of the Justice League movie have been tweeting out support for hashtag release the Snyder Cut.
Yeah, this came out of nowhere last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
As I think Zack Snyder was posting on his Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Just pictures of like Henry Cavill from Justice League that wasn't in the final movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for people that don't know, Zack Snyder was working on that movie for most of the time, then had an unfortunate incident where his daughter committed suicide, and he and his wife were two of the people working on it, and they decided they had to step aside for a bit to deal with that. You know, completely...
understandable.
Yeah, understandable. In came in... who was it? Who was the director that came in for him? I forget what his name is. But somebody else finished it, and they did their own shooting and all that stuff. And so he was like sharing these weird shots of his cut of the movie. This has been a thing that DC Cinematic Universe people have been obsessing about on social media for a year or so now. Suggesting there's this magical new cut of the movie that makes it so much better. Probably doesn't. But he decided to start like posting these cryptic screenshots, and then Ben Affleck just tweeted out hashtag release the Snyder Cut. I think Gal Gadot and the others. Yeah, it's pretty weird.
I say do it. I mean, DC's got their streaming service. It's, I think, underway now.
Yeah. You know, I've seen people...
People want it. It's free money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. People's posting rumors suggesting like they're waiting for HBO Max. Is it the new service?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Even Jason Momoa posted on his Instagram like a video about this and called it the Cinder Cut. he just kept typoing on this. But yeah, seems like a weird thing, but also, yeah, there's, they mentioned here at the end, it's like, it's also kind of maybe not a great idea because the part of the community that's been obsessing about this is not exactly, the best part of their community.
Nope.
Very much the shittiest people in their community have been obsessing about this.
Naturally.
Yeah. Cause they blame all what the movie is on Joss Whedon. It says here it was the director. Yeah. It's like, oh, they fucked it up. It's the Zack Snyder's cut is the perfect one. It's the one that will really get it shining. And it's like, it's probably not. it probably didn't change that much to make it. And so like giving into
them. Still a chance to take their money.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be the ultimate decision. I assume DC cares about is, it's another way to get some money out of them.
Yep.
Especially as they're starting to write the ship for the DC universe.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, get this last bit of money here as we start getting better projects out there.
Yep.
With Wonder Woman 1984, there's what else? I think they're doing another Joker. Todd Phillips. There's just rumors going on about that, which is weird, but. Trying to figure out the Batman thing that's eventually coming out at some point once they figure out who's in it and then can film it. But yeah.
All right.
That might happen. Maybe not. Who knows? It's a DC Cinematic Universe conspiracy out there. That now just has big names attached to it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well then. So next up, so Apple has this original film that they've recently made called The Banker. It's a biopic. It's about a guy named Bernard Garrett Sr., who was this African-American gentleman who wanted to start this financial business about 60 years ago. But, you know, this was before the Civil Rights era, so... He basically had to recruit a white guy to basically work as his front man. Basically, for a while, one of the big guys that had been tacked on in producing this thing was his son, Bernard Garrett Jr. And then on November 5th, you know, he was on stage at an entertainment industry event, you know, talking about it, hyping up the movie. And then after that, all of his credits have basically been taken away from all publicity materials, and the film's premiere was actually scrapped. And people are wondering, well, why? Why is it? Well, both of Garrett Jr.'s half-sisters, who are roughly 15 years his senior, have basically gone to Apple and have made them aware of the fact that They claim that when they were younger and living in his home, he molested them over the course of a few years.
Jesus.
Ooh-wee.
And they then further pointed out that the movie, the timeline that's presented in the movie is tweaked in such a way so that it leaves the girls and their mother out of the story completely and instead replaces them with Bernard Garrett Sr.'s first wife. Even though by the time of the events in the film, they had already divorced.
Yeesh.
Yeah.
I could kind of see why Apple would want to just distance themselves from this.
Just throw it in the incinerator.
Yeah. If the allegations are true, of course. And well.
Yeah. And like the movie story kind of changes some of the actual events to kind of cut these... sisters out of it.
Yeah.
And the mom, I think.
Yep.
So that's also like a weird wrinkle to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because the son is a producer on the film. So he obviously had some influence on how it would be, how things would be told.
Yeah.
All right. All right. And finally, last story for the night. We finally got a trailer for Jordan Peele's new series for Amazon Prime called Hunters.
And it's about hunting Nazis.
Yeah.
Yep.
In New York in the 70s.
Yep. So as you can guess, this is right up my fucking alley.
Yes.
Yeah.
I liked this trailer. It was actually kind of good.
It's Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, he's got two solid films and a moderately successful television series under his belt. So.
Yep. And he's also got Al Pacino here.
Yeah. Yep. Which automatically makes it even better.
Yeah.
Especially when he's in something that you can tell has some actual care in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Going into it.
Either this or The Irishman. Both of them. Yeah.
Look really good.
Which, by the way, has anybody seen the? Have any of you guys seen The Irishman yet?
No, it's.
I don't. I don't think it's on Netflix yet. I know
it just
that,
had its theater run.
Yeah, but it was kind of a small theater run because
just for Oscar consideration.
Well, yeah, and also because Scorsese's been having this fight with some of the Hollywood bigwigs about distribution or something like that, which is part of the reason why this movie's getting on Netflix so soon.
Well, did Netflix bankroll it?
I think they probably did. And I'm surprised that the big Hollywood studios wouldn't bankroll this because, I mean, look at the fucking cast.
I know.
It's like, it's Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, and Joe Pesci. Like, the trifecta of Scorsese's best work all in one movie. But whatever. Anyway. All right. So we got ourselves a show, folks.
That we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would like to remind all of our listeners, if you've got a question, comment, something you want us to read on the air, you can contact us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got it linked for you in the show notes. On top of that, on top of Apple Podcast, if you want to listen to our little bit of unscripted shenanigans, you can also find them at TuneIn, Google Play, RSS, archive.org, pretty much any kind of podcast aggregator you can think of. So, with that, I have been your host, Brandon Perkins, and for Filippo D'Onofrio, Patrick Mifflin, and Chris Zoloji, good night, please be safe this Thanksgiving, and please keep the interfamiliar homicide coming about from the political arguments to a minimum.